Hi, this is Spider Robinson, apologizing for being late this week with Spider on the Web number 33, a user-supported Renegazoo being podcast, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial, share alike. You might want to keep your hand near the volume control. We're opening loud tonight with a loving farewell to the great Jeff Healey, who just caught a cab at age 41. Here he is opening a blistering set in London 18 years ago, Jeff Healey and My Little Girl. One of the great blues singer-guitarists of all time, no question, Jeff Healey. Eye cancer took Jeff's sight when he was 1 year old. His family would take it kindly if you'd care to make a donation in his name to Daisy's Eye Cancer Fund at www.daisyseyecancerfund.ca. That's daisyseyecancerfund.ca. Now, next week, I hope to bring you some of the music that Jeff Healey actually loved playing best, acoustic music, the heartbreakingly beautiful gypsy jazz he played with his astonishing group, the Jazz Wizards, at a place in Toronto called Jeff Healey's Roadhouse. It's sad to report, yesterday I managed to throw my back out so badly that just sitting here at my desk is painful. That's why this podcast is late this week, and that's why from here on it's going to consist entirely of canned me. reading the opening chapters of Blackstone Audiobooks edition of Callahan's Legacy. I figure when you're in pain, head for Callahan's place. It's been working for me for 35 years. Without further ado or a don't, I bring you me. Callahan's Legacy. Chapter 1. Too Hot to Hoot. The immortal storyteller Alfred Bester once said that the way to tell a story is to begin with a disaster and then build to a climax. I'd like to. Believe me, I'd like to. But this particular story happened just the other way around. It was a good climax, at least. Well, okay, maybe that's a silly statement. Perhaps you feel that there is no such thing as a bad climax, that some are better than others, is all. I could argue the point, but I won't. Let's just agree with Woody Allen that the worst one I ever had was right on the money, stipulate that they're all at least okay, and try to quantify the matter a bit. On a scale of 10, then, rating the least enjoyable orgasm I've ever had as a 1, and reaching the culmination of hours of foreplay with the sexiest partner imaginable after years of celibacy as a 10, the climax I'm speaking of now was probably about a 9.5. This despite the fact that every one of the ingredients I've named for a 10 were present. The foreplay had been so extensive and inventive, and the afterplay wasn't so bad either, that the sun was coming up by the time I was going in the other direction. My partner was the sexiest woman on the planet, my darling Zoe Berkowitz, and she was my first real lover, as opposed to mere sexer, in more years than I cared to think about. True, we had already been lovers for several months by then, but the honeymoon was by no means over. In fact, it still isn't. The way I see it, our relationship is really just a single, continuous, ongoing act of lovemaking, a dance so complex and subtle that we often disengage bodies completely for hours at a time. My father used to say, "Familiarity breeds content." And that's always been my experience. No, what brought the meter down as low as 9.5 was merely a matter of mechanics. Zoe, thank God, has never been a small woman, not since the 6th grade anyway, and she was 9.5 months pregnant at the time all this happened, in the late fall of 1988. Indeed, if I could travel in time like Mike Callahan and went far enough back into hominid history, I think I could prove my theory that pregnancy is responsible for the evolution of man as engineer. This might help explain why there are so few female engineers. A man who has successfully managed the trick with a mate in the latter stages of pregnancy possesses most of the insights necessary to build a house, and a strong motivation in that direction as well. If inventing math were as much fun, we'd probably own the galaxy by now. But I digress. As I was saying, Zoe and I had solved the riddle of the Sphinx together one more time, just as enough dawn glow was sneaking past the edges of the curtains to let us see what we already knew, and neither of us was paying attention to any damn imaginary scoring judges. We were both well content, if a little fatigued. By the time we had our breath back, the day was well and truly begun. Birds had begun warbling somewhere outside, and traffic was building up to the usual weekday morning homicidal frenzy out on Route 25A. Why are they all in such a hurry to get to a place they hate and do things they don't care about? A combination of sounds that always puts me right to sleep. That's probably just where I'd have gone if Zoe hadn't poked me in a tender spot and murmured drowsily, "What you snickering about?" I hadn't realized I was. In fact, I wasn't. "I'm not," I said. "I'm chuckling." She shook her head. I like snickers better than chuckles." I considered a couple of puns having to do with the physical characteristics and components of the candy named, but left them unspoken. Sexual puns are funnier before you come. "Chortling, then," I said. "Definitely not a snicker." Zoe grimaced, her eyes still glued shut. "But why are you?" "Oh, it's just this silly mental picture I get after we make love," I admitted. "I keep seeing little nameless floating in there, startled awake by this rhythmic earthquake, and then staring in fascination as all these millions of confused, exhausted, disappointed little wigglers show up looking everywhere for an egg. I bet they tickle. The little tyke must get a chuckle out of it." "Or a chortle," she agreed, chortling sleepily. "I will do from now on, thanks. Neat image." She yawned hugely then, so of course I did too, and we did the little bits of physical backing and filling necessary to move from cuddling to snuggling, and we'd probably both have been comfortably asleep together in only another minute or two. But we had forgotten about the invisible machines of Murphy. universe is full of them, and many of them seem to be simple pressure switches. For instance, there's one underneath most toilet seats. Your weight coming down on the seat somehow causes the phone to ring. Unless you've brought the phone in with you, in that case the switch cues a Jehovah's Witness to knock on your door. There's another one built into most TV remote controls, wired into the channel select button. If you try to browse, it somehow alerts every station on the air to go to commercial. The most maddening thing about these switches is that, being of Murphy, they're unreliable. You can't be sure whether or just when they will function, except that it will usually turn out in retrospect to have been at the most annoying possible moment. So, the tiny pair of switches under my eyelids, sensing that I was just about to drop off to sleep, pick now to send out the signal that causes my alarm clock to ring. Excuse me, I mean to... For the past 2 weeks, that damned thing had been going off at just this ungodly hour, set by mine own hand and with Zoe's foreknowledge and consent, and every single time it came as a rude and ghastly surprise. Neither of us could get used to it. I had been a professional musician for a quarter of a century until I gave it up to 10 bar. Zoe still was one, or had been, right up until carrying both a baby and a bass got to be too much for her. It had been decades since either of us had willingly gotten up at dawn. Dawn was what you occasionally stayed up as late as. Sunlight gave you the skin cancer, everybody knew that. Civilians got up at dawn, for heaven's sake. Well, so do 9.5-month pregnant women, and their partners. No matter what their normal sleep cycle is. Being more than 9 months pregnant may mean nothing at all. Not even when you get up to 9.5 months and the kid hasn't even dropped yet. Maybe you just guessed wrong on the conception date. We don't want you to worry, Ms. Berkowitz, but maybe, just maybe, something is wrong in there. Maybe little Nameless doesn't want to come out and play, ready or not. If so, it is a bad decision, however much one might sympathize, because once Nameless is ready, he or she will begin to do what all fully formed babies do best, excrete. And polluting the womb will die, and possibly take you along for company. The chances of this are low, but it might be wisest if you just checked into the hospital now, Ms. Berkowitz, and allowed us to induce labor with a Pitocin drip. Zoe had awarded that offer an emphatic, "Fuck you very much, doctor," and I was behind her 100%, at the time. We had both devoured most of the available literature on birthing as a subversive activity, and were determined to do this naturally. Not with drugs and episiotomies like postmodern drones, but the way our primitive ancestors did it in the caves, with a trained Lamaze partner, a camcorder, and a physician standing by just in case. As far as we were concerned, Nameless could emerge in his or her own good time. The hospital had seen all too many zealots like us. They sighed and agreed to let us wait as long as we could stand it against advice, provided we were willing to furnish daily proof that Nameless was not in fact dying in there, in the form of a maternal urine sample, which they would need first thing in the morning, every morning, wherefore, as far as I can see, the biggest disadvantage to having a pregnant lady around the home is that it's always your turn to get up. I said a few words, and Zoe stuck an elbow in my rib, saying, "Not in front of the baby," so I said some more words, but in my head, and got up out of bed. As I went around the bed, I confirmed by eye that her chamber pot was placed where she would be able to conveniently straddle it, and went to the bathroom to get another specimen container from the package under the sink. If you think 10 yards is too short a walk to the bathroom for a chamber pot to be necessary, then you've never been 9.5 months pregnant. And then, well, it got complicated. I bent over, see, and took the package by a scrap of torn flap at the top and straightened up, intending to rummage inside the thing for a specimen container once I got it up to around waist level. But Zoe had been pregnant for 9 months and 13 days, and those damn packages hold a dozen, so it was empty. And since it was empty, it didn't weigh anything. And since I was expecting it to weigh at least something and was more than a little groggy, well, I overbalanced and landed ass first in the bathtub, wanging my head against the tile wall. It could have happened to you, okay? I'm sure it didn't, and it never will, but it could have. And if it had, I wouldn't have laughed at you. Oh, all right, I'm lying. Go ahead. Zoe had apparently decided to rest her eyes until I got back and then get up into a sitting position when there was someone there to help. But her love was true. I believe the combination of my piteous wail and the loud reverberating boom were probably enough to cause at least one of her eyes to open, perhaps as much as halfway. "You alive, hon?" she murmured. I was dazed and not honestly sure of the answer, but I could not ignore the concern in her voice. "Depends on what you call living," I temporized, trying with little success to get out of the tub. Her reply was a snore. My struggle triggered another of those invisible Murphy switches. The showerhead's built-in bomb sight detected the presence of an unsuspecting human in its target area and cut loose with the half cup or so of ice water it keeps handy for such occasions, scoring a direct hit on my groin. That got me up out of the bathtub, at least, though I can't explain exactly how. All I know is an instant later I was standing up and drawing in a breath to swear. Loudly. With a great effort, I managed to squelch it. The useless, empty paper sack that should have held specimen jars was still in my hand. I flung it angrily toward the wastebasket beyond the toilet bowl. But, of course, it had poor aerodynamic characteristics for a projectile. It fluttered and flapped and curled over and fell short square into the toilet bowl. 2 points. This time I was not entirely successful in suppressing my bark of rage. It emerged as a kind of moan. I turned angrily on my heel and walked straight into the edge of the open bathroom door. The sun went nova, and when it had cooled, I found that I was sitting again, on the cold tile floor this time. The front of my head now hurt as much as the back, and my buttocks hurt twice as much. Outside in the bedroom, Zoe snored again. For the third time, my lungs sucked in air, and then let it out again very slowly. If I woke Zoe with screamed curses, I'd have to explain why, and then refrain from strangling her while she giggled, or chortled. I got up, rubbed the places that hurt, and turned my attention to the problem of improvising an alternate urine container. If it had been for myself or another male, no problem, but females need a wider aperture. I shuffled past the sleeping Zoe and left the bedroom searching for inspiration. By the time I found it, I had left our living quarters completely and wandered out into Mary's place proper. Living in back of a tavern has been a lifelong dream of mine, and the reality has turned out to be even better than I imagined. There, for instance, ranked in rows behind the bar, were a plethora of acceptable receptacles. Say that 3 times fast with marbles in your mouth, and you'll never need a dentist again. Before selecting one, I punched a combination into the machine and set a mug upright on its conveyor belt, which hummed into life and whisked the mug away into the interior. Less than a minute later, it emerged from the far side of the machine, filled now with fresh, hot Tanzanian peaberry coffee adulterated to my taste. I took it and the specimen container I had chosen back into the bedroom. There are few things a very pregnant woman will wake up for, but peeing is definitely one of them. Getting Zoe to a sitting position on the side of the bed without tipping over the chamber pot was probably less difficult than portaging a piano in rough country. The smell of coffee may have helped. She took a long sip of it and then came fully awake when she recognized the receptacle I was offering her. "Jake, I am not peeing into a stein." "Oh, hell, Zoe, what's its religion got to do with anything? It's wide enough, it's been sterilized, it's got a lid I can tape shut after we're out of specimen jars. Just go ahead and get it over with, okay? Whoever it is today will be here any minute." My best friends in the world, a.k.a. my regular clientele, had organized what they insisted on calling a pee pool. Each morning, one of them took a turn at coming by Mary's place to pick up the day's specimen and ferry it to the hospital for analysis. I had no idea whose turn it was today and was too groggy to figure it out, but the way things were going, I suspected it would be one of the rare prompt ones. Zoe thought it over and relaxed to the inevitable. She set the coffee down where I couldn't reach it without stepping over her, deployed the stein above the thunder mug, and cut loose. Sure enough, just as she finished, there was a thunderous knocking. A distant thunderous knocking at the bar's front door. That irritated me. Whoever it was could just as easily have come around to this side of the building and knocked on the much closer back door. As a gesture of my irritation, I tossed aside the underpants I had just managed to locate, snatched the filled stein out of Zoe's hand, and set off to answer the knock stark naked. "Jake," Zoe called after me, and I snarled, "Whoever it is has it coming," over my shoulder. For the second time that day, I padded out of the living area and into the bar, went through the swinging doors into the foyer, and flung open the outside door with a flourish. And was vouchsafed a vision. It had to be a vision. Reality, even the rather plastic kind I've learned to live with over the years, simply could not, I felt, produce a sight like that. Nor was it mere hallucination. I had not had a drink in many hours or a toke in several days. The thing was so weird that it took me a full second or two to learn to see it. At first, my brain rejected what it was given and searched for plausible alternatives.
"This object is a fire plug. No, a fire plug's older brother, over which someone has draped a very used painter's drop cloth and onto the top of which someone has placed the severed head of a pit bull. No, wait, pit bulls don't have mustaches. Perhaps this is the secret midget son of Buddy Hackett, wearing a paint-spattered toga as part of his fraternity initiation. No, I have it now. This is R2-D2 dressed for Halloween. Or maybe..."
We gaped at each other for a good 5 seconds of silence, the vision and I, before I tentatively and correctly identified it as the ugliest woman I had ever seen. The moment I did so, I screamed and jumped back a foot, and at the exact same instant, she did the exact same thing. The difference was I was holding a nearly full stein. The lid flew open when I started, and a glog of the contents sailed out into the air, an elongated fluid projectile like a golden version of the second liquid metal model Terminator. It caught her amidships and splattered, the splat sound overpowered by the clop of the stein lid slamming shut again. There was a short pause, and then she barked. I mean barked like a dog. In fact, yapped is closer to the sound she made, but doesn't begin to convey the impact. Even barked isn't strong enough. Maybe bayed. Imagine a 200-pound Pekingese with a bullhorn, and you've only started to imagine that sound. It was something like all the fingernails in the world being drawn across all the blackboards in hell and then amplified through the Madison Square Garden sound system at maximum gain. I shivered rather like a dog myself, blinked rapidly without effect, and felt my testicles retreating into my trunk. The vision barked again, louder, a sound which you can duplicate for yourself if you wish by simply inserting a power drill into each ear simultaneously. As its echo faded, I heard the distant sounds of Zoe approaching to investigate. She pushed the swinging doors open and joined me in the foyer, stopped short, and gaped. I was finally beginning to believe it was a human woman, or something like one, gaped back at the two of us, staring from the naked hairy man to the extremely pregnant woman in the ratty bathrobe. She opened her mouth to bark again, paused, blinked, looked down at the damp stain on her chest, sniffed sharply, the sight of her hairy nostrils flaring will go with me to my grave, glared up at me and then at the stein in my hand and then back at me and then down at the stain on her chest again, then one more time at Zoe, and finally she threw back her head and howled. A couple of glasses burst behind the bar. I heard them just before my hearing cut out completely, as though God had accidentally overloaded the automatic level control on my tape deck. I know I tried to scream myself, but don't know whether I succeeded. I also tried to jam my fingers into my ears to stop the pain that continued long after actual hearing had fled. Not only didn't it help a bit, the stein I had to abandon to do so landed squarely on my bare right foot with a crunch I did hear by bone conduction and sprayed the last of its contents onto the creature's behaired shins, pilled socks, and orthopedic shoes. A pity, for it caused her to sustain her howl longer than she might have otherwise, and to shake at me a fist like a small wrinkled ham. Horrible as that shriek was, and it was even without being audible, the end of it was worse, for now she had to draw in breath for the next one, and so I saw her teeth. I can see them now. My eyes sent my brain an urgent message asking how come they had to stay on duty when my ears had already bugged out. With that, my guardian idiot snapped out of his stupor and reminded me that I did not have to endure this trial any longer than I chose to. I closed the door, quietly but firmly, in her face. Then I stood on one leg and cradled my mashed foot in both hands and hopped in pain. Then I lost my balance and fell down, for the third time that morning, on my bare ass, banging my head again, too. For those of you who are connoisseurs of anguish, a hardwood floor is perceptibly harder than either tub or tile. Zoe, bless her, did the only thing she possibly could. She burst out laughing. I did not join her, not right away. I tried a withering glare, but if age cannot wither nor custom stale my Zoe, no glare of mine is going to do the trick. Then I thought about kicking her somewhere that wouldn't endanger Nameless, but now was not a good time to get beat up. Next, I opened my mouth to say something, deeming it safe because I assumed she was still as deafened as I by the vision's banshee cry.
but before I could, I realized that the deafness must have worn off. I could hear Zoe's hoots of helpless hysteria now, and the distant and fading sound of that monstrous barking outside. So I closed my mouth, prepared a slightly less offensive speech, opened my mouth again, and clearly heard the sound of knocking. Distant knocking. Not here, but at the back door, back in the bedroom, where one of my friends must be waiting to receive the daily beaker of piss. Now I joined Zoe in laughing. Well, I just had to. It was that or go mad. The louder and more urgent the distant knocking became, the harder we laughed. Finally I got up, collected the empty stein, and went, still laughing, to answer the knock. "What the hell was that?" Zoe asked, as we walked back toward our quarters, wiping away tears of laughter. "I think it was a person," I said. "I'm pretty sure it was a life form of some kind, anyway."
"If you say so, I wonder what in God's name she wanted. What language is that she was speaking?"
"I'm not sure she was evolved that far. Come on, hurry up," or... Needless to say, by the time we got to the back door to answer the knock, the knocker, Noah Gonzalez, had given up and gone round to the front door. I left Zoe there and retraced my steps through the entire building, for the third time, before coffee, and got to the front door moments after Noah had given up and gone round to the back door again. "That's it," I thought. "I quit." I went as far as the bar, made a second cup of coffee, and vowed not to move another step until I had finished drinking this one. Zoe and Noah must have connected and worked out for themselves the awkward business of him waiting in the bedroom while she waddled into the bathroom and refilled the stein for him. No problem for a pregnant lady. By the time she came out to find me, carrying my bathrobe, I was putting the finishing touches on the lyrics of a new song. They go like this. God has a sense of humor, but it's often rather crude. What he thinks is a howler, you or I would say is rude. But cursing him is not a real productive attitude. Just laugh. You might as well, my friend, because either way you're screwed. I know, it sounds so simple, and it's so hard to do, to laugh when the joke's on you. God loved Mort Sahl, Belushi, Lenny Bruce. God likes it sick. Fields, Chaplin, Keaton, anyone in pain will do the trick, because God's idea of slapstick is to slap you with a stick. You might as well resign yourself to stepping on your dick. It always sounds so simple, but it's so hard to do, to laugh when the joke's on you. Well, you can laugh at a total stranger when it isn't your ass in danger, and your lover can be a riot if you learn how to giggle quiet. But if you want the right to giggle, that is what you gotta do when the person stepping on that old banana peel is you, a chump in a banana peel, the core of every joke. But when it's you that steps on one, your laughter tends to choke. Try not to take it personal, just have another toke. As long as you ain't broken, what's the difference if you're broke? I know it sounds so simple, but it's so hard to do, to laugh when the joke's on you. It can be hard to force a smile as you get along in years. It isn't easy laughing at your deepest secret fears. But try to find your funny bone and have a couple beers. If it don't come out in laughter, man, it's coming out in tears. I said it sounds so simple, but it's so hard to do, to laugh when it jokes on you. Ask Michael Jackson, said it sounds so simple, but it's so hard to do, to laugh when it jokes on you. The barking vision did not return. Chapter 2. Too far, Edna. We wander afoot. That evening started out to be a fairly typical night, at least by the standards of the patrons of Mary's Place, and its proprietor and chief bartender, myself. Not that the evening had been uneventful. By 10 o'clock, just under 30 of us had put away about 13 gallons of booze, though admittedly something over 11 gallons of that had gone directly from their various bottles and kegs to the throat of Naganin, our resident Irish cluricon, without ever occupying the intervening space. Like their cousins the leprechauns, and indeed like all the Dini Shi, cluricons have a paranormal PSI power, in their case the ability to teleport and absorb alcohol, and Naganin feels that pouring, lifting, and sipping are shameful wastes of good drinking time. On the bright side, he paid for every drop he drank, cash on the bar, in gold coins so pure it would take a tooth mark. And, of course, he tended to be a very agreeable drunk, neither pugnacious nor pathetic, neither morose nor manic, both merry and mannerly,
I guess a few hundred years of practice must count for something. Thanks to our other resident Irish myth, Ernie Shea, the lucky duck, a half-breed puka around whom the iron laws of probability tend to turn into extremely silly putty, we had even had a brief spell of weather indoors. At about 9 o'clock, one of the very few tornadoes in Long Island's history had suddenly sprung up out of nowhere and lifted the roof clear off the place, neat as you please, and scaled it away into the night like a frisbee. The noise and suddenness of the roof's departure startled us a bit, naturally. Doc Webster, though, rising to the occasion, as he so often does, glanced up nonchalantly and said, raising his voice over the howling wind,
"A gable roof, I see. Gone with the wind."
And there can't be many sights sillier than a room full of people gaping up at rain falling on their faces. But fortunately, it is not possible for any of us at Mary's Place to get wet when it rains, thanks to an alien cyborg friend of ours. I'll get to that later. And besides, by now we had all acquired a certain sense of just how the duck's luck tends to run. We simply covered our drinks with our hands to prevent their dilution and waited it out. Sure enough, another roof came along in a few minutes. It was a good enough fit, and apparently it arrived with all its nails bristling because it installed itself with a solidity that we could hear and feel was reliable. Indeed, it turned out to be slightly better than the roof I'd traded for it in one respect. Like its predecessor, it had a built-in hatch for rooftop access, but this hatch was better positioned, farther away from the bar, so that I would now be able to get a stairway up to it and allow my customers the option of doing their drinking under the stars. I'd have to put a fence around the roof, of course. After that, well, let's see. Once the floor had dried sufficiently, Ralph von Valvau, the talking dog, got out his latest short story and read it aloud to us, turning the pages expertly with his muzzle and paws, and dropping, for the duration of the reading, that silly fake accent he usually puts on. Well, okay, I have to admit a German shepherd speaking in a German accent is kind of amusing. And after he was done and we finished applauding and commenting and petting him and so forth, we all spent a while chatting with the Internet. Not chatting on the Internet, chatting with the Internet, with its self-generated, artificially intelligent avatar, whom my true love Zoe had named Solace, and who had for several months now been manifesting herself at infrequent intervals through the house's souped-up Mac 2, augmented with camera and microphone. The chat was of a fairly standard type. We tried to think of Turing tests that Solace couldn't pass, and she tried out a few Turing tests of her own on us. Like I say, a pretty routine night for us at Mary's Place. It was nearly 10 o'clock before anything I'd classify as weird happened. Solace had just aced our latest home-brewed Turing test, a speech recognition homonym discriminator devised by Doc Webster. This consisted of correctly displaying on screen, as the doc dictated it without pause for thought, the following nonsense sentence. "I was musing on the muse under some yews outside SMU's museum, as I'm used to doing, when a kitten's musical muse drew me into the museum's muse, which some use, damn muse, to sniff mucilage for amusement." This is, of course, just an extended variation on Heinlein's classic construct, "though the tough cough and hiccup plow him through." That is, a sentence designed to confound just about any imaginable speech recognition system short of a human brain or functional equivalent. As far as I'm concerned, software capable of grokking that all six of Heinlein's different sounds are spelled identically, or that the single repeating sound in the doc sentence can and must be semantically interpreted 13 different ways, is software that meets my criteria for sentience, whether it's neurons or wet or dry. What matter if such sentience consists of, quote, nothing more than, unquote, a large sheaf of complex algorithms? I don't know about you, but a good half the human beings I run into on the street are, or seem to be, on automatic pilot, navigating by a series of pre-stored algorithms, clumsy, primitive rules of thumb. Can't see that it makes any difference whether the algorithms are expressed by meat, machine, or Martian. As the last words of the doc's test sentence appeared on screen, correctly spelled, a mild cheer went up from those 10 or 15 patrons who were paying attention. I'd like to pause right there for just a second and preen, if I may. I think I have a right to be a little proud. At age 45, I ran the kind of bar where a live, real-time chat with the net come alive was not necessarily the most interesting thing in the room. Over at the opposite end of the house from the sparkling fireplace, for example, Ev and Don were playing tic-tac-toe with smoke rings for an appreciative crowd of onlookers. Don't ask me how Don can blow an X. All I can tell you is they seem very happy with each other. And in another corner of the house, the Darts Championship of the Universe, a weekly ritual, was in progress.
The lucky duck had agreed to accept as handicaps both a blindfold and the tying of both hands behind his back, and nonetheless was clearly going to seize the crown from Tommy Jansen, the reigning champion. It was just a matter of time. His luck was with him, you see. But I digress. As I was saying, Solace successfully displayed that silly sentence in 36-point Bengat font on her 14-inch monitor if you're a computer weenie. And, by the way, did you know that nanotechnology fans are known as teeny weenies? As fast as Doc Webster could say it, and was applauded by something like a dozen onlookers.
Way to go, Solace, Long Drink McGonagall called out.
Thank you, Phil, Solace said. Ever since we had decided that Solace was more of a she than a he, she had spoken aloud to us through the stereo speakers I'd hooked up to the Mac 2 in a warm contralto, not unlike Zoe's.
Oh, hell, the drink went on. These days it's probably PhDs in English who couldn't spell that sentence correctly. Even I might have had to hesitate a second or two here and there.
These days there are PhDs in English who can't spell PhD, Tanya Latimer said gloomily, and her husband Isham nodded agreement. Marty Mathias spoke up.
My grade 12 students at St. Dominic's all did rotten on the last exam I gave them, so to try and cheer them up a little, I told them the inspirational story of how Albert Einstein himself failed math when he was in school, right? A hand goes up in the back of the room. Mr. Mathias, he says, not kidding, honestly puzzled, I don't get it. If he was so lousy in school and everything, how come they called him Einstein?
There were cries of horror, outrage, and protest, but no disbelief.
I don't know what to say. I stood there with my mouth open until the bell rang.
Doc Webster sighed.
It's the Tude and Janie effect, he announced.
The which? Longdrink asked.
Creeping? No, galloping illiteracy. The township repaired the sidewalks in my neighborhood recently, poured fresh concrete, you know. Naturally, kids with popsicle sticks condensed out of the ether to immortalize themselves with the concrete poetry.
There were groans.
Well, sir, right in front of my house, where I have to look at it every time I go out, there is now inscribed a large heart within which lie the dread words, Tude and Janie.
Huh? Chorused half a dozen people at once.
Now, I know the world has gotten weird lately, the doc went on, but I still don't believe we reached the point where any set of parents would name their son Tude. I am forced to conclude that young Todd can't spell his own fucking name.
This brought shocked laughter.
Old enough to be horny for Janie, mind you, and the boy can't spell his name. Miracle he got hers right, her mom must have sewn name tags onto her underwear.
That got even more laughter.
Long Drink shook his head. How much you want a better name is Jeannie, he asked, and the laughter redoubled.
Wait, I got a topper, Tommy Jansen said.
The lucky duck had just finished skunking him at darts, tossing all five shots with his teeth and then punting them into the bullseye with his own eyes closed, and Tommy had naturally gravitated to the nearest source of laughter to soothe his wounds.
I was in the men's room down at the library, and I was reading the graffiti on the wall of the stall to pass the time, right? And at first I was bummed out because all the ones I saw were racist. But then a pattern began to emerge, and I cheered up a little. The first one I saw said, Packies suck, but the author had spelled Packies, P-A-K-I-S apostrophe. The next one read, K-K-K, the Klan is back, only Klan was spelled with a C. But the third one was the best. He was trying to say, death to anyone wearing a turban. But the last word was spelled T-U-R-B-I-N-E.
By now people were whooping.
Which, as far as I know, lets out everybody but Mickey Finn and maybe the Terminator. So the bad news is, racism is on the rise, but the good news is, they're even stupider than ever.
The laughter became applause, and a number of empty glasses sailed across the room and met in the fireplace with a musical sound. I think it was about then that I first noticed the newcomer enter my bar. I remember wondering if a barrage of flying glasses was going to put him off. Newcomers to Mary's Place, and we don't get many for I don't advertise and there's no sign outside, sometimes take a while to dope out that all the silicon shells are ending up in the fireplace. But this guy seemed to take a rain of glasses in stride. It even seemed to tickle him. I liked him for that. He was about 50 or so, close on to 6 foot, clean-shaven with short gray hair, which was dry, the rain must have stopped outside, dressed casual and cheap, save for an exceptionally fine pair of boots that looked like some kind of exotic, endangered lizard skin. When I saw their heels, I revised my estimate of his height downward by several inches. Since he carried an acoustic guitar case, I took him for a fellow musician, who had heard about Mary's Place through the folkies' grapevine. He must have observed a couple of toasts being made as he covered the distance from the door to the bar. I believe Doc Webster started it toasting,
"To the American educational system, God bless it,"
and flinging his empty glass into the fire.
and then Tommy stepped up and replaced him at the chalk line and said, "Literates, next on Oprah," drained his own beer and unloaded his own empty into the flames. Anyway, by the time the new guy bellied up to the bar, he seemed, from his expression, to have intuitively grasped the essential nature of our most central custom, and I could see he approved of it. More points for alertness and class.
"What'll it be, friend?" I said, going through that silly little ritual of pretending to polish the bar top in front of him. "A cold day in hell before I find another bar as interesting as this one," he said agreeably.
Well, I agreed with him anyway.
"Not many innkeepers let you smash your glass in their hearth anymore these days."
He held up his guitar case.
"Okay if I set this thing on the bar a minute?"
It was a big case, but there was ample room.
"Sure, let me mop up some of the spills and circles for you." "Oh, no need," he said, and set the case down on the bar. "I won't be needing the case much longer."
I was finding him as interesting as he found my bar. "Why not?" I asked him. He was fumbling with the latches.
"Oh, I intend to empty it, for good."
He got the last one open and lifted the lid. It blocked my view of whatever was in the case, and I wrestled with the question of whether it would be polite or prudent to shift my position a little and sneak a glance over the opened lid. What kind of guitar was this man proposing to destroy? Or was that a machine gun in there? Standing behind him, Noah Gonzalez suddenly did a double take, then made it a triple, gaping at the open case. That decided me, but before I could move forward, the stranger plucked something from the case, took it at either end with his fingertips, and snapped it taut. It was, or appeared to be, a $100 bill. Noah nudged his nearest neighbor, Susie Mazur, directed her attention to the stranger and his guitar case, and Susie did what may have been the first quadruple take I've ever seen. A crisp, new $100 bill, it looked to be. He folded it lengthwise, and it took a crease between his fingernails. He folded one corner over to meet the central crease, then did the same with the resulting new corner. Then he repeated the procedure on the opposite side. By now, Noah and Susie were no longer the only ones staring. I glanced over the lid. That entire jumbo guitar case was packed with what seemed to be genuine U.S. currency. All of it, or at least all the ones visible on top of each banded stack, crisp, starchy $100 bills. I knew less than an innkeeper probably really ought to know about spotting counterfeit money, but these looked pretty good to me. My intuition told me they were genuine. I couldn't estimate the total, but something told me it would have the word million in it somewhere, quite possibly in the plural. I looked back up at the stranger. He had folded one raked outer edge back to meet the central crease and was doing the same with the other. Maybe half my customers were discreetly watching now. The buzz of conversation faltered. By the time I had allowed myself to believe that I was watching a man make a paper airplane out of a $100 bill, he had it airworthy. He grinned briefly at me, turned around to face the fireplace, and let fly. The bill soared gracefully across the room. By the time it arrived at the hearth, most of the eyes in the place were tracking it. It was damned well aimed. The sudden updraft over the flames made it try to climb up the chimney, but too abruptly it stalled, rolled out, and augured into a chunk of birch, falling over and bursting into flame. All eyes traveled back to the stranger. I guess he'd been confident of his aim. He was already halfway through the next C-note / paper airplane. The general reaction was unanimous. Once people were satisfied that he had torched the bill intentionally and meant to continue doing so for a while, they politely looked away and went back about their own business. The noise level in the room went back up to normal. Oh, no doubt many of them discussed the stranger, but did so in politely hushed tones, without any unseemly gawking or pointing. I stared at the guy closely, but I had professional obligations. I figure if a man comes into my bar and starts setting cash on fire, I have a moral duty to assure myself that he isn't drunk before I decide whether to sell him liquor. I'm much better at detecting drunkenness than I am at detecting counterfeit money, and it was clear to me that while he was not cold sober, neither was he nearly bombed enough to call for intervention. "You want any help with that, cousin?" I asked. Our combined reaction, or rather lack of it, delighted him as much as our glass-smashing custom had. "Why, thanks," he said, and gestured for me to help myself. I signaled Tom Hauptman, my backup bartender, to take over the job of keeping everybody else's glasses refilled. He nodded and went to work with the industry you would expect of a former minister. So I busted the paper tape off another stack of hundreds and fashioned the top bill into a paper airplane. When I had it done, I set it close to the newcomer's hand and built another.
Soon, we had it sorted into a system. I made the planes, and he launched them. The only attention anyone else paid was to make sure they didn't wander into his line of fire. His aim was impressive. Before too long, he had to pause and wait for the pile of crashed seaplanes to burn down a bit so that new arrivals wouldn't spill out onto the floor. "This is really nice of you," he said. "This was going to be my last attempt before I gave up the whole idea. The last three places I tried this, people got very upset." I nodded. "I can see how that could be. Riots have started over less." The third time, I picked a really upscale bar, a Hamptons joint where a Coke cost $5 and a rum and Coke cost $10, on the theory that people who actually had money to burn would be the least upset to see it done. Ha! I thought they were going to Merrill Lynch me. I had blasphemed their religion. How many rum and Cokes will this buy me here? He offered me one of his pale green aircraft. "None at all," I told him. "I'm afraid I deal in nothing but $1 bills. "Singles? Seriously? How come?" I shrugged. "House custom. Call it homage to the memory of a departed friend. It's a long story." He grinned. "Do you actually mean to tell me that with a guitar case full of $100 bills, I can't get a drink in here? Oh, that's marvelous." "Well," I said, "I judge you to be a special case. How about if on a one-time basis I change one of those into singles for you?" He looked thoughtful. "Oh, how many drinks would 100 singles buy me, hypothetically?"
"That depends."
"Well, say they were all rum and Cokes."
I shook my head. "No, that's not what it depends on. Every drink in the house, from Coke to Irish coffee to champagne, costs $3. But if you turn in your empty glass or mug or whatever, you get to take a dollar back from the cigar box over there." I pointed it out down at the end of the bar closest to the door.
"So, hypothetically speaking, well, let's see, 99 singles would buy you 33 drinks, but if you didn't toss any of your empties into the fireplace, you'd be entitled to raid the cigar box for another 33 singles, treat yourself to 11 more drinks, then go get 11 singles from the box, add them to the dollar you still had left from your original 100, and have 4 more snorts for a nightcap, then take 4 singles, have 1 more for the road, and walk out with a buck in your pants. Plus whatever leftover $100 bills you don't have time to burn by closing, if any. This is just theoretical, of course. I wouldn't sell a man 49 glasses of orange juice. And I'd cut you off once you were down to cab fare. I don't let anyone leave here drunk with their car keys. But it comes down to $3 a drink, a dollar back if you return your empty."
He was staring at the cigar box, sitting there unattended at the end of the bar, singles spilling over its sides.
"What keeps anyone from filching a fistful of those on their way out?" he asked.
I shrugged again. "Honesty? Integrity? Self-respect? Enlightened self-interest?" He grinned delightedly. His grin was almost manic, his gaze intense.
"I'm beginning to like this place. You don't find many bars with a flat rate, much less a free lunch of dollar bills. But look here, if I let you break that yard, well, let's say I'll have 3 or 4 drinks tops. That leaves me with 88 and possibly 92 singles to dispose of."
He gestured to his open guitar case.
"As you can imagine, I expect to be somewhat arm-weary by the time I've emptied this thing. Another 94 missiles might just be the straw that broke the camel's wrist."
"I see your problem," I agreed. "After you burned a guitar case full of hundreds, how much fun can there be in burning singles?" He smiled. I wish I saw guys in their 50s smile that big more often.
"Well, how about this? Why don't I just give you 100 and we'll call it an advance payment on my tab?"
He looked around the room. Don and Ev were holding a crowd with pornographic smoke rings. The Lucky Duck was trouncing Slippery Joe Mazur at darts by flipping him over his shoulder, and the Chloricon was dancing a jig upside down on the new rafters while Fast Eddie played the C Jam Blues on his beat-up old upright.
"I think I'm going to be doing a lot of drinking in here. You people are crazy as a basketball bat."
"Yeah, we're weird as a snake suspenders, all right," I agreed. "Welcome to Mary's place. I am Jake Stonebender."
"Rogers is my name," he said.
I hesitated. "Ordinarily, I don't ask a man's first name if he doesn't offer it to me, but in your case, I think I'm going to make an exception. No offense, but I just don't think I can call you Mr. Rogers with a straight face for any length of time." He sighed.
"I quite understand your problem, but it isn't going to get any better when I give you my first name."
"Try me." I made up my mind not to laugh, whatever he said next.
"My parents, for reasons which have always seemed to me inadequate, elected to name me for my Uncle Buckingham."
I managed to keep my face deadpan with great effort, but a nasal sound like a snore played backwards soon escaped from me despite my best attempts to suppress it.
"No, go ahead," he said understandingly. "You'll hurt yourself."
I gave up and released a large bolus of laughter.
He waited it out. I tried my best to keep it short, but it just kept coming and coming. I mean, it was beyond perfect. It would have been a funny name anywhere, but here it had added impact. Buck Rogers had walked into Mary's place. Hell, we should have been expecting him. And the first thing he'd done was to start rogering Bucks. I finally got it under control and stuck out my hand. Buck, I apologize. See, you don't know it yet, but you were born to find this place. That's why I couldn't help laughing. It's not your name so much as the appropriateness of it. I've actually heard much worse names.
Name two, he challenged me.
Well, I know of a guy in Yaphank named Bang who actually named his daughter Betty, swear to God. And a friend of mine, a sci-fi movie buff named Ted Leahy, got himself married to a fellow fan, an Asian-American feminist named Susan. Now he began for the first time to truly relax, and seemed pleasantly surprised that nothing bad happened when he did.
"The coffee is Celebes Colossi," he said slowly.
I nodded. Lately it's considered more polite to call it Sulawesi, though.
"But what is that whiskey? It's like Bushmill's Black Bush, only better." He shook his head. "Only that's impossible."
I nodded again. "Ain't it? They call it Bushmill 1608. In honor of the year Mr. Bushmill started distilling. As I get the story, the progression goes like this. Plain, unquote, Bushmills is, of course, ambrosia, the water of life itself. The Black Bush, which they've only just started selling outside of Ireland, is that ambrosia mixed with some that's been in the cask a dozen years. But the 1608, presently available only on the Emerald Isle, is just the 12-year-old stuff. Beyond describing, isn't it? Long Drink McGonagall over there smuggled a case back with him from a vacation in Anwaym, his family's ancestral home. It just seemed perfect for the occasion, somehow. By the way, today in 1995, I'm happy to report that you can buy 1608 in any good liquor store. That is, in fact, the definition. He was already three-quarters of the way through, sipping slowly but repeatedly.
"Almost a pity," he said between sips, "to mix it, sip, even with coffee, sip, even coffee like this."
He was done. He paused to savor the sensations he was experiencing, then smiled broadly, set the mug down, and said,
"Would your hospitality extend to another Jake?"
But I had already started working the minute I saw his reaction to that first taste. In moments it was ready. I put another mug on the belt for myself and brought his to him. "Here you go." He had gone back to making money airplanes, but he paused again to drink half of his second cup.
"Well, I better get back to work," he said, setting it down. "I've got a lot of it ahead of me, and the night is middle-aged."
"I'd be glad to give you a hand," I offered. He thought about it.
"Sure, jump in, Jake."
So I fetched my own coffee, took a second packet out of the case, busted it open, and began my own aeronautical assembly line on the opposite side of the case from where he was working. It was distinctly pleasant work, I soon found. There is something fundamentally satisfying about folding a $100 bill into a paper airplane and then sailing gracefully into a large fire. I no longer doubted the bill's authenticity in the slightest. They felt and smelled like real money. I wondered why I'd never tried this before. I had the wild thought that perhaps I had stumbled onto a great secret, that maybe this was why some people bothered to become rich. I'd always wondered about that. If you had more money than you could possibly spend, why then you could do this whenever you felt like it. I was wishing I could ask you why you were doing this, Buck, I said after a few minutes, but I think I understand now. The pleasure is worth the expense. This is fun.
That it is, he agreed dreamily, pausing in his work to sip his blessing.
The best part, I can't get over how nobody's paying the slightest bit of attention to us. I like your customers, Jake. But hey, why couldn't you ask?
Oh, because it would have been a snoopy question, I said.
You see that little guy over at the piano, Fast Eddie? Anybody asks a snoopy question in here, Eddie has orders to 86 him, and he ain't gentle about it.
Even you?
Even himself. It's a house rule.
He looked Eddie over and shrugged. Man sure plays good. Plays like he's got three hands.
That he does.
Well, I'd hate to fight with a three-handed man, especially one that talented. Why don't I just take you off the hook and volunteer the information?
Up to you, I said.
I can put it in three words. Spain and Portugal.
I frowned. Spain and...
Well, didn't you ever wonder about them? Spain and Portugal used to rule the world, you know. The whole damn planet. The Pope drew a line on a map of it one day and gave half to Spain and the other half to Portugal.
Oh, sure, I agreed. That's why they speak Portuguese in Brazil.
And what the hell happened?
Third-rate powers at best today, both of them. The two of them together couldn't take France in a fair fight, and just about anybody can take France. How could they fall so far, so fast? Did you ever wonder?
Oh, I don't know. I guess like Rome before them and England after them.
He shook his head vigorously.
No, a totally different thing. What destroyed Spain and Portugal was treasure. The shipload after shipload of gold they took from the New World. They really did, you know, and not all of it ended up on the ocean floor. They thought they were in hog heaven. The poor saps must have thought they were importing wealth by the ton.
I must have looked puzzled.
Weren't they? No. They were importing money. Gold is not wealth. Potatoes is wealth. Corn is wealth. Potable water is wealth. Gold is just money.
I began to get it. Oh, my.
Right. All of a sudden, there was much too much money around and very little more real wealth than there'd been the day before. Too much money chasing a fixed amount of goods. Their currency inflated, their prices rose, their balance of trade went all to hell, and finally their economies collapsed so totally that centuries later they're still trying to dig out from under the rubble. The only real wealth to be had in the New World was real estate. And what little wasn't taken away from them, they had to let go at fire sale prices.
Wow. It was an ironic notion. Death by money.
That's why I'm doing this, he said, launching another bill toward the fire. Our own economy's in the toilet for much the same reasons. We've got too many dollars chasing too few potatoes.
Huh. And a vice president who can't spell either one, I couldn't resist adding. This was 1988.
So you mean you're doing my civic duty as I see it? If you'll forgive a dreadful pun, the bucks stop here. The damn stupid government is trying to cure the deficit by printing money. I'm opposing them. I'm tightening the money supply one tiny notch. For the same reason you mentioned why your customers don't swipe singles out of that box down there. Enlightened self-interest. I figure it's better to be broke in a healthy economy than rich in a dying one.
You know, I said slowly, that's so crazy it almost makes sense.
I think so, he agreed. Oh, I know this is too small an amount to have any significant effect. I started out with well under 2 million. But it's all I can do, and I won't shirk it. Like Johnny Lennon said, we're all doing what we can. I'd burn more if I had it.
I'll be damned, I murmured.
So I thought about it. Suppose I suddenly came into possession of a few million bucks. What would I do with it? The more I thought about it, the more it seemed to me that being suddenly handed a couple of million dollars would be a fucking disaster. For a start, I wouldn't particularly want to change my present lifestyle much. I like my life. If I bought all the toys I really crave and all the books and CDs I could ever use, just went hog wild, I'd say I could use up 100 grand or so, tops. Peanuts. I don't think I'd care much for the company of other rich folks either. The few I'd run across in my time, it seemed to me distinctly unenviable. And yet, it's hard to hang out comfortably with anybody else but other rich people once you're worth a few million. The imbalance inevitably puts a strain on both sides of any such relationship. Educating myself to the point where I'd be capable of intelligently and ethically managing or investing that much money would take years of distasteful skull sweat for which I am spectacularly ill-suited. I'm just this side of innumerate, and I gave up trying to do my own taxes when I was 20 years old.
God, think of the tax headaches! Inspire the IRS to shine that big a flashlight on my tax situation and history,
I'd be in perpetual audit for the rest of my life, long past the point where all the money had hemorrhaged away into the federal coffers. If I let the IRS have my millions, then I would be much more personally responsible than ever for what the government would ultimately do with them, and I didn't want that on my conscience. But even just learning to protect myself from the IRS was probably beyond my abilities, and who could I trust to do it for me? Who said I had better judgment than, say, the Beatles? The record of history was clear. The only kind of people who could hang on to sums of money on that scale without being bled dry by their agents and friends were the people who had been born to that calling, and none of those people ran a bar or played folk music for a living. Think of the horrid publicity alone. Okay, my name isn't Buck Rogers, but the name Jake Stonebender is, let's face it, just weird enough to catch the eye of the fine folks at Hard Copy and the National Enquirer in the same way. I'd end up spending every dime the government left me just to try and get some peace. I remembered a guy back in the 60s who inherited a bundle and went on TV talk shows soliciting worthy causes to donate it to. I seem to recall he had ended up in a rubber room. Ethically disposing of several million bucks sounded like a job as complex and demanding as that of, say, a mayor or a governor, but without the glamour or perks. I found myself concluding that if someone ever gave me a guitar case full of $100 bills, the smartest thing I could do might be to find me a reasonably crowded bar, so there'd be lots of witnesses if the IRS ever asked, and then pitch the whole kit and caboodle into the fireplace. "You know, Buck," I said as we folded and threw his money together, "this may be one of the smartest ideas you ever had."
"I think so," he said, nodding. I was this close to hearing Geraldo Rivera's talent coordinator on my answering machine.
"Among many others," I agreed. "Well, anyway, I just want to say it's a privilege to be part of this. Thanks."
That made him smile.
"No problem."
Then he glanced into the guitar case and frowned slightly. "Except that
here, and we don't get much walk-in trade." "Well, that was the damnedest thing," he said. "I was driving along 25A, and all of a sudden this freak tornado sprang up, and a goddamn roof went sailing across the road ahead of me."
I glanced across the room at the lucky duck and made a mental note to give him free drinks for the rest of the night.
"I was so startled, I swerved into the first curb cut I came to and skidded to a stop, and it turned out to be your place. Once I stopped shaking, I shut the engine and just sort of sat there a while, and just as the rain stopped, it came to me that I could use a drink."
"How did you know this was a bar?" I asked, curious. "There's no sign outside or anything."
"Well, I guess it was the way the cars are parked in the parking lot, pointing in all different directions, like a herd of cats."
"Yeah, that would be a clue to a thoughtful man," I admitted.
"How come you haven't asked me where I got the money?" he asked.
"Well, it would have been," I began, and we finished together.
"A snoopy question."
"Damn, that's manners," he said. "I appreciate that. But I don't mind telling you about it. Remember that uncle I told you about, Uncle Buckingham? Well, the reason my parents named me after him was Uncle Bucky was richer than store-bought sin. They hoped he'd leave me a pile when he went. And by God, it worked. It took 50 years, of course. He bought the farm last month, 96 years old, and I'm his only living relative, and here I am setting fire to every dollar he was able to acquire in a lifetime of diligent anal retention. I like to think that with every bill I burn, his soul gets a little lighter."
"I'll bet it does at that," I said.
"Oh, my God," he breathed. "A ghastly pun has occurred to me."
I nodded. "Yeah, it happens all the time in here. I think it's some chemical we all give off. Let's hear it."
"Well, I'm having a little trouble making it gel, but..." He held up one of his $100 bills. "What's the slang term for one of these?"
"A C-note," I said obligingly, always happy to midwife an especially ugly pun.
"And a C-note, C-E-N-O-T-E, is a geologist's and engineer's term for a hole in the ground. And unlike my anal Uncle Buck, I know the difference between my ass and one of these."
I awarded it a groan.
"Not bad. Okay, let's get this show on the road." I raised my voice. "May I have your attention, ladies and gents?"
I don't suppose I've ever had less trouble getting the undivided attention of everyone in the room.
I imagine most, if not all of them, had been dying to be invited into the conversation. In something under a second, all other social intercourse had been suspended, including the darts game, and the only sound in Mary's place was the crackling of the flames.
"My friend Buck here,"
I said, "would like some help burning this money." The response was immediate and enthusiastic. There was a short, rousing cheer, and then my friends swarmed round and got down to business. With a minimum of conversation, folks figured out how many tables needed to be pushed together to allow everyone access, and selected a spot near the chalk line from which toasts are made, and moved the guitar case there and began stacking piles of bills around it. And a massive kamikaze airstrike on my fireplace began. I had to leave off tossing myself shortly in order to help Tom Hauptman take orders for fresh drinks. Soon, we were both so overworked that Buck, who had already thrown enough bills to be developing a cramp, left off himself and came around behind the bar to give us a hand. There was a definite party atmosphere in the room, and it was shaping up as one of the most enjoyable parties I'd ever been to. I even went back and woke up Zoe, who can nap through a riot, because I knew she wouldn't want to miss this occasion. It would be good for the baby. But then... well, remember back when I said some things happened that night that I classified as weird by the standards of Mary's place? Well, it was just then, as I got back with Zoe, that the first of them happened.
Well, in the immortal words that got Buffalo Bob fired from Howdy Doody, that ought to hold the little bastards. But even with a spasming sciatic nerve, I can't leave without shouting out to the world my joy that my friend Jamie Matthews, associate professor of the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of British Columbia, was appointed last month to the Order of Canada by Governor General Michel Jean on February 20th. Jamie is a stellar seismologist by trade, widely known, however, for his work on the MOST Space Telescope project, and known to readers of my work as one of my principal science advisors for Variable Star. He is also one of the jolliest souls I know. Congratulations, Jamie. Thank you for indulgence, folks. I'll see you next week with a healed lower back and some amazing music by Jeff Healy and others. For now, this is Spider Robinson thanking you for your donations and subscriptions and inviting you to come back next week for Spider on the Web 34. If you have any questions in the meantime, visit spiderrobinson.com.